everybody, we are about to launch into a conversation we had with Jeffrey Veen. So we thought that we would do the sponsors here at the top and the bottom, rather than interrupting in the middle of our conversation just for this week. So this episode is brought to you by lynda.com. That's L-Y-N-D-A.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. You got to go to the Shop Talk URL for your 10-day free trial. That's lynda.com/shoptalk. Lynda.com is for problem solvers, for the curious, for people who want to make things happen. Maybe you want to master Excel, learn negotiation tactics, build a website, or boost your Photoshop skills. Go to lynda.com to feed your curious mind. I sure do that once in a while. Love it, love it, love it. And the Content Strategy Summit, literally contentstrategysummit.com. It's coming up September 21st and 22nd. Content is the biggest pain point with web building. Learn how to level up with content strategy by taking 2 days with the industry's best trainers without leaving the office at a virtual live content strategy summit. Like I said, coming up this 21st through 22nd, you'll recognize some people that we've had on the show, like Christina Halverson, in an online round table, all kinds of great stuff there. Stephanie Hay. Oh gosh, I can't wait to go to this thing. That's literally contentstrategysummit.com. And now under our conversation, we'll tell you a little bit more about both these things after that.
Nailed it. Wait for it. It's right here.
Hello, Shop Talk listeners. This is Dave Rupert, and today we got a very nice episode. I'm with Chris Corrier, of course. Chris?
Hi, Dave. We do have a special one. If you've been listening the last few weeks, it's because you like our show and subscribe to it, presumably, but you're also aware that we're deviating in our normal Q&A structure a little bit to bring you some different styles of shows. One of the most
who are we ripping off this week, Chris?
Well, no, it's not anyone in particular. In the past few weeks, we have not ripped off, but homaged, borrowed from some podcasts that have very specific formats, and we copied them just for fun. And this one, there's nobody specific that we're copying because it's the interview format, which is just what I feel like most of the podcasts are in this world, because it's such an interesting format, because you get to talk to interesting people. And so we queried the web to find the literally the most interesting person who's ever lived. That's Jeffrey Veen. Thank you for joining us, Jeffrey. Hi.
It's a pleasure. Thanks guys.
Sorry, I didn't mean to, you know, set the bar too high, but I think no pressure. Very long, interesting career. Everything this man touches turns to gold, I think. Let's start. I mean, our plan is to travel through time and to ask you about what it was like during certain parts of it, and bring us all the way up into kind of what you're doing now. You are a design partner at True Ventures, right?
That's right.
Oh, that's so cool. We're going to find out what being a design partner at a venture capital kind of place is like, but I guess we'll save that for the end and start at the beginning. Do you have a favorite place to start? I think the typical Jeff Veen bio starts with Wired.
Yeah, I guess so. The Wired magazine, where I started. Oh my gosh! All right, I have to say this out loud. I started at Wired magazine 21 years ago, and I was hired there to work on their first website,
which is pretty cool. So was it exactly? I was kind of confused by how the Wired thing goes. Is like the print mag. I still subscribe to the print magazine now and get it, and it's an amazing magazine, and I read it.
Still is.
Was it always different than? Are they have always been the same thing?
No. I mean, honestly, the fortunes and pitfalls of Wired magazine really map very well to how the web as an industry has evolved over the past 20 years. So the magazine started in, I believe it was January of 1993, where they sort of handed out the first issue at Macworld, Like, that's how they kind of started everything. Wow. And yeah, yeah. It was about 14 months after that, I guess, in 1994, when they started to put together a new project, which was going to be a parallel and separate project for the web, which was called Hotwired. And not the, you know, travel search engine thing we have today, but this was quite literally one of the very, very few commercial websites in that it was supported by advertising. And that's when I was hired. Like, when I came on, my first duties were to start to help the small team. There was, I don't know, maybe seven of us or eight of us, mm-hmm. the small team, to try to figure out how do you make web pages, and how do you how would you do advertising on such a thing, and how would you try to even like build a community around this thing? And literally at the same time, I was also responsible for like migrating content out of Quark Express documents into AOL. Like, that's the environment we were in at that time. And
it was I'm reading the Wikipedia page for CSS Open, just to set the stage a little bit. It says CSS 1 was completed in 1996. This is before CSS even existed.
There was, I think, 16 HTML tags, and there was no Netscape browser. We were working in Mosaic. Netscape actually, the Netscape browser, the first version, came out after we had launched. So you know how today we have vendor prefixes, and you try to map out like what features am I going to support and not support. The conversations that we were having then about what to support and not to support were things like HTML forms and HTTP authentication and stuff like that.
You could have a form, but it might be risky because not everybody can see
it. Not everybody can see it, right? We were certainly designing a page, the pages for not everybody being able to see images, because, oh, probably 25 to 30% of the audience browsing at that time was not yet, had not yet upgraded into a browser that supported inline images.
Wow.
So that's the environment we were in. Like, yeah, it was crazy. So,
and it was a commercial in that you would put content there, and with sponsors and stuff, right? There was still some way to extract money out of it. I mean, it was, maybe you're just figuring that out, but.
Well, we had the advantage of being a very, very popular magazine, and a magazine that was all about this thing that was at the time called the digital revolution and the information superhighway. Maybe you remember some of those terms, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we were able to go to the more progressive advertisers in the magazine and say, would you like to be on this new product that we're making? So it was not a difficult sell at first. And honestly, like, nobody had ever seen advertisements on the web, so the click-through on those advertisements on the pages were phenomenal. Like, sometimes they were up to like 25% of people would click on the ad banner, you know. And now we're in these, like, yeah, you know, microscopic
0.025%, like, killing it.
Yeah, no kidding, right? And very few of the advertisers even had websites, so we literally just like built landing pages with email addresses for the advertiser on them and stuff like that. So, so it was, it was certainly, I mean, I don't know, it seemed like we had all the opportunity in the world, whereas today we look back and it was remarkably constrained, but like, what would we have been comparing it to back then? Like, computers not connected to one another. So this was remarkable and amazing, and look at all the stuff we could do. So as difficult and just like simplistic as it sounds today, it was actually overwhelming with the opportunity that we had back then.
Had you or any of your team built a website at this point? I mean, 1994 is very, very early on. Are you?
I had.
Or were you just kind of?
Yeah, I had. A couple of other people had, you know, personal websites, had like a Tilde account on some server somewhere. That kind of stuff. I applied for the job at Wired by emailing them a URL to an HTML version of my resume, which
nice,
which was
still
frankly
a good idea.
Which was frankly all it took to stand out from a crowd. Right? Like, they were like, "Whoa, this guy! Holy cow! URLs, HTML, like nobody knows that. Come on in. We should talk to you. So it probably takes a little more to stand out these days if you're on the job hunt. But back then it didn't.
Still a good idea. So, okay. So the Wired magazine's online thing was called Hotwired. And then there was WebMonkey, which wasn't it kind of like for practitioners in a way?
Yeah. So then Hotwired had essentially channels inside of it where we did all sorts of stuff. We had very early like QuickTime videos and showed like different artists and animations and things like that. And we had a bunch of different channels. The channel that was probably near and dearest to my heart was WebMonkey, which was the simple premise that it was built on this premise that we were trying to figure out what was happening on the web, how to make websites. We were literally figuring that out as we went along because there was nowhere to go learn because nobody else had figured it out yet. And so we sort of wrote it all down and we had it on what I guess today we would call an intranet, right? Just a private mm-hmm. web server where we wrote this all down. And then June Cohen, who was the head of editorial for Hotwired at the time, said, well, here's an idea. Why don't we just not make that private and make it public and share that with everybody? And we're like, yeah, of course. That makes so much sense. So we turned on WebMonkey and it was enormously popular. It was, I think, changed a lot of stuff. Like, we wrote a tremendous amount of content just tracking what you could do in web browsers. And that was an almost infinite amount of content back then. I mean, today too, right? But yeah, that was really, really fun. So I wrote a column, a weekly column on browsers and web design, sort of loosely. And I did that for like 2.5 years. So I wrote, you know, a couple hundred or about 150 of those columns. And that was kind of a transition into then getting invited to speak at places. And I wrote a couple books on web design as a result of this work that I did on WebMonkey. Yeah.
Now that's interesting. That's because that's echoed over and over, I feel like, to this day, is that that's sort of a ticket into this world so often is the writing thing. Just write some stuff, people will read it, and that ends up being the why they invite you to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the vast, vast majority of people do not do that, right? So it is still a way of getting, I don't know, some notoriety or at least saying to people, hey, I think I know what I'm talking about, you know? Like,
pretty cool. And gosh, both of the, you know, so often it's easy to talk about things from 20 years ago, especially tech things, and be like, well, remember that? Ha ha ha. Both Wired magazine and even WebMonkey still online today. I don't know if WebMonkey's really kicking so much. It looks like their last post was from a couple of years ago, but still, at least it's kind of archived and there.
Yep. Yep.
One of the kind of big things that your name gets attached to is the web standards redesign of Wired.com, I believe it is. Can you maybe take us back to that and why that was a big deal and why that is still kind of talked about today?
Sure. I will defer almost all of the credit for all of that stuff over to Doug Bowman, who I worked very closely with and has for all these years been just a dear, dear friend. And Doug, as you guys probably know, went on from Wired and came to Google, where he and I worked together again. And then subsequently, he went from Google over to Twitter, where he was creative director for years. And his career has been just phenomenal. The influence that he's had in both the techniques, about early techniques for doing design without all of the hacks that we had to have, just pure standards-based validating CSS and HTML. He invented so much of what we did, and likewise did so with beautiful and elegant design, as opposed to like, this is just purely a technical matter and here's how you do the hacks, or here's how you get around the hacks and do, you know, proper work. But he did so with stuff that was so inspiring. So yeah, and Doug and I worked together quite a bit on a lot of the stuff at Wired Magazine. In fact, he even designed one of my books. We work so closely together. And that collaboration, I think, was a little bit him inventing stuff and me validating it technically. I served for a few years on the W3C advisory board for CSS and HTML. And sort of going back and forth that way. So we had this sort of direct line into where the browsers were going and what we should be doing. And we could kind of validate that for them with our work on Wired. But also then popularizing and using WebMonkey as a way to amplify what we were figuring out there and to show off so much of Doug's work. So that kind of dovetailed into what Jeffrey Zeldman and Eric Meyer and all those other people were doing with the web standards, the WASP, the web standards project, right? And I think that really kind of made that big shift right around 1999, 2000 or so in the so-called browser wars, where we were sort of giving up and saying, crap, I guess we're going to always just use the Internet Explorer and really get... held the browser makers' feet to the fire and say, nope, look, this is going to be the platform for the future. Let's raise the bar here, everybody. And it worked.
It's great to hear that it was such a team effort. I think, you know, people kind of glom onto, oh, Jeff wrote a blog post, so he must be responsible. So therefore it was a one person show, but it was very much a team, you and Doug working together.
Oh, it's like that for everything. Almost all my time is spent in the startup world and with entrepreneurs, and we can get to that. But the thing the press loves is the genius, right? The Zuckerberg, the Jobs, Steve Jobs. Like, they want to have this like lone mad scientist who invents all this stuff and single-handedly changes the world. Like, that's the story everybody always looks for. And that is, that's never the case. If you go back and read biographies of like Thomas Edison and how many other concurrent inventions were happening at the same time for the stuff that he was ultimately given credit for and took the attribution for, not to mention the tremendous team he had around him in his workshops and labs and whatnot, that's always the case. And it's important to remember that that we are all, especially now in this world where all content is sort of shared instantly around the globe, we are all just contributing to each other's work. And it feels like this tremendous industry-wide group collaboration to move things forward.
Speaking of old blog posts there, Dave, one of the things we've been doing on the show a little bit is talking about some old writing that has kind of lived up over time. That's an interesting, and some of it has happened back around this, I don't know, some of the time periods we've been talking about. There's a classic one that gets brought up all the time, which is that Tao of Web Design article by Mr. Alsop.
John Alsop.
From 2000. There's a Derek Powazak book called Design for Community that was released in 2001 that feels prophetic to read even today. We just did a podcast about a essay called The Cathedral and the Bazaar.
Oh, sure.
That was very interesting. Yeah. That has kind of held up over time. I think Dave might have been digging through the Veen blog articles a little bit.
Veen gold mines.
And there's one.
There's a post from 2004 you wrote called "I Don't Care About Accessibility." I don't know if you remember it.
Oh, I remember.
Perhaps
that.
You do. Yeah. And legend has it that it was inspired from a South by Southwest talk or kind of. What would you call it? Like a kerfluffle at South by Southwest?
No, it wasn't at all. In fact, let me tell you the story. It's a really good one. And yeah,
this is great.
I still love that blog post. So I had written that up on the plane on the way to South by Southwest, just as some speaking notes, right? Like for a panel discussion that we were having on web accessibility. And the plane, I had to like fly through Denver to get to Austin from San Francisco, and the plane was so late. And I was, you know, that anxiety of like, oh my God, I have this, I was flying the day of the panel, which was a terrible idea, but the only thing that I could do with my schedule. And I was like, I'm not going to make it. And I get to Austin, I run through the airport, I jump in the rental car, I like break every traffic law to get to the convention center where the event is happening. I'm looking at my clock on the dashboard, like the conference started or the session started 2 minutes ago. As I pull up in front, literally like, you know, the Blues Brothers in the cop car where they like just
drop it off,
just leave the car on the sidewalk. I just left the car. I'm running through the convention center. I see my brother like at the conference, and I like throw him the keys to the car, and I'm like, there's a rental car out there and it's going to get towed and I have to speak. And he's like, what? And I come running into the auditorium And the panel, and they had just started, and like he had just started doing introductions, and the moderator was like, "Oh, you're here," and like ran up, sat down, and tried to catch my breath, and then we started this conversation about about
and were your first words, "I don't care about
I don't care about accessibility."
Care about accessible parking. So
that is all to set up. Like there was some adrenaline going on when I down there. But I had this plan, you know. And if you read the blog post, like the spoiler on the blog post is that I do very, very deeply care about accessibility. Of course, I think that is part of the beauty and phenomenal success of the web is that any piece of content can be available to anybody regardless of their ability to see or interact with it or whatever, right? Like that's almost unprecedented in the history of the world. Amazing. But you don't need to specifically go and make your stuff accessible if you do web standards properly, right? You kind of get it for free. That is the quote unquote goal of writing standards-based content and design is that it just degrades gracefully down into something that anybody can consume. But I remember this because literally I sat down in this chair on this panel. My heart was racing. I have this plan to say something really controversial. I look to my left. The guy sitting next to me is blind and has a seeing eye dog like sitting between the two of us. And I'm about to say, "Oh, I don't give a shit about accessibility." So...
I'm full Picard facepalm at this point.
Yeah. So you can imagine, like, this is one of those things where you kind of read the energy of the room, and man, did I have a, like, here I come running in late. I sit down. The guy who had just been introduced is like this, like, guy who has been building a Braille browser. And then I sit down and go, yeah. And then I say, I had a lot of work to bring the audience back, but it worked. And actually that message really resonated with people. And so I think that's a little bit of that legend.
Oh, that is a good story.
That's a good story. So can I wanted to read one paragraph and then ask you a question about it at the end. And this is spoiler if you haven't read the blog post yet, but so I end up delivering solutions to my clients that are far less complex to implement, are much easier to maintain, cost exponentially less to serve, work on multiple browsers and devices, do way better in the search engine lottery, and of course are accessible to everyone using the web today, and try to argue the business value of that. I personally think that's a very beautiful way to approach websites. It's sort of the simple wins, like Jobsian philosophy. Right. But I guess my question is, do you, as the web has grown, you know, in the last... 11 years since you wrote that post, do you still believe that this is how the web should be today? And if you were writing that post today, what would you maybe change, or how do you feel it's aged?
So I think it was written in a context of like at the time I was a consultant for Adaptive Path. I was a partner of this consulting group that we founded to do strategic consulting for companies using user research and user experience. And I wrote that in the context of these arguments that we would get into on these projects with clients where they didn't want to pay extra for accessibility. They didn't want to pay extra for all the browser support. Couldn't we do something simpler and just target one browser and not worry about all the standard support? And I was trying to turn that argument around and say, actually, what we need to do is consider the design to be able to make it simpler, which will in effect be both higher return on your investment and cheaper to produce in the long produce and maintain in the long run. And I think that conversation absolutely has not changed over the decades,
ago. Articles that are posted to consider the business value of responsive design, consider the business value of web performance. Do you find these conversations like, thank God we're still having them, or is it tiresome that we still have to have them?
Oh, you know, both, sure. I mean, honestly, it feels like we are in this era of design now where design is not only celebrated and seen as a competitive advantage, but I mean good design, right? Like but is also an era in which designers are increasingly getting more responsibility and authority and power inside of organizations, which is all great, but it feels like this overnight success that we've been working 20 years to get to. And I think the same is true for standards-based design or responsive design, I guess is the term we would use now, and things like that. But the other thing is to sort of like scroll back to that 11 years ago, the context I was writing that in is also an era where desktop browsers were the only thing we were working on. And there was a diversity of them, and it was still difficult to do that. But there was no... But there was no other devices that we were really using the web on. And the environment we're in now is so dramatically different that to some degree, like, I think that has shifted a bit in that I would say that's all true for content, but that for most of the interfaces that we're building today, we're moving more and more towards native apps. And I actually celebrate that as well. And I think that's remarkable, but it's a very different conversation from responsive web design and standards-based design.
Yeah, it's true. There may be not standards-based native app design. It's not really a thing.
Or it is so incredibly regimented that you can't not do it. Like, if you don't write your apps the right way, they don't get submitted to the store.
Right.
So to some degree, we have grown over this past couple decades into a discipline of like, here's how we're going to do it, because we actually know this works the best way. And we test that all the time. And we have these, you know, pushbacks from Apple or Google or what's happening on either one of those platforms. But at the same time, I think that actually points to the industry becoming much more mature, as opposed to some of the arguments I've heard about it becoming much more limited. And I don't really buy that. I think that we are finding this blend of online content, much of it, almost all of it, formatted as HTML and presented with CSS in a beautiful way and a usable way in the context of many native apps. But honestly, in the stuff that I see today, I don't see a lot of pure web apps attempting, especially in a consumer world, to really to be the primary interface. Like, the entire interface and interaction will be in HTML and CSS anymore, JavaScript. That's not a finality sort of statement I'm making, but it is definitely the trend is moving more towards native apps. And it's really interesting to see where web design is going in that context. But I may have just taken us down a rabbit hole.
You already mentioned that you were a partner at Adaptive. This is kind of the middle years, as it were, the Adaptive Path. And then while you were at Adaptive Path, you were at this thing that I know nothing about called Measure Map, which was a short-term thing because it got snapped up by Google, right, and led to your kind of Google
that's
years.
That's a pretty quick story. That was we started Adaptive Path, and we worked building a consulting practice. And we got about four or five years into it, and I realized, man, consulting's not really my thing. Like, I love the diversity of all the projects, but the fact that you're solving other people's problems, that you can't get engagements that last long enough to do multiple iterations to really understand an audience, all of that stuff is not to undermine the practice of professional services and what agencies can do. Just it didn't suit me. And so I convinced the rest of the partners, hey, we should do a product. And we should do that internally here. The thing we came up with was this idea of an analytics tool for bloggers. Because at the time, this is 2004 that we started working on it. Honestly, like, there were no real way to figure out if your blog was doing well or not, with the exception of this. Remember those little odometers?
Before Technorati. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Sure.
Those little odometers, a page counter, hit counter, actually. Hit counter things that people would put on their sidebars.
That was, like, as good as you could get for figuring out how many people.
At the time, it absolutely was. And so we built this very, I thought, elegantly designed platform for integrating with all the blogging tools that would give you a dashboard of how your blog was doing. We worked on it for about a year. We got it up to about 1,000 customers, and then Google bought it. And I left Adaptive Path to go work at Google to join another company called Urchin that had been acquired. We combined forces and designed Google Analytics. And so that was the big middle chunk of time.
That's right. I can remember a period in which when you put Google Analytics on your site, it was like urchin.js or something. It was kind of...
That's right. That was the name of the company and product that became the back end, and then MeasureMap became the front end. And that was honestly some of the most rewarding design work I've ever done in my career was that work that went on to Google Analytics. And now, just, I mean, the impact that that's had has been really rewarding and satisfying. Yeah, for sure.
Yes, it's just yet another thing that I'm sure it looks a lot different today than it did then, but still I'm sure there's traces of it that live on, and still a thriving, useful product that tons of people use. Pretty wild. So then that leads into truly the middle years was the leaving of Google and the big idea type on the web.
Yeah, well, I mean, you guys were probably part of that conversation as well back then, right?
We're a part of the conversation.
Well, that was 2008, I think it was, right? When I think, again, John Alsop, who originally wrote the Tao of Web Design, wrote another sort of seminal blog post about why are we not doing fonts on the web? This is crazy. Like the CSS spec for fonts, for the at font face inclusion of in CSS was written in 1997. Like, what the heck? It's been 10 years. Let's just do this. And he convinced Opera. He convinced WebKit. He convinced
I didn't know that we can credit Firefox. John for for
he convinced them so much as he sparked another debate.
Yeah,
and that debate started. And that was right at the time we were coming out of Google. I had left. I had convinced two of the people that I work with, have worked with to this day, my brother and my good friend Ryan Carver, convinced them to leave Google as well. And then the guy who ran the business over at Adaptive Path, Brian Mason, the four of us got together and we're like, all right, let's go do something. And before we did that, I went on vacation to Australia. I went to Sydney for a couple weeks, had lunch with John Alsop, and he's like, hey, check out this font thing. And that sort of was where the kindling was of like, wait a minute. Like there's this doesn't have to just be moved forward by another web standards committee project, right? This could be moved forward by a business because people pay for fonts. And the fact of the matter is they often don't. And I bet we can make it easier for people to use fonts appropriately than for them to sort of pirate fonts and do it and that was honestly part of the very honest conversation we had with a lot of foundries. I'm like, look, the number two Google result for all of your fonts right after your website is
sites.
Free Gotham.
Free Gotham. Yeah, exactly.
That was probably a fairly easy business meeting to have then. I mean, you can just show – I mean, they probably were aware of it before you even showed them.
Well, yes, and they were terrified that that was going to be amplified by by the browsers supporting what we were calling like native raw web fonts, right? Like you put the font on the server, then the loads and on when the web page is loaded, and then it works.
Yeah, and you look like, under the hood, and you'd be like, it is.
And they were like, wait, back up to that part where you say you put the font on the server. Let's talk about that a little bit. And so that was where. A bit of commercial technology, right? We were like, look, DRM doesn't work. You're not going to get people to install something just to see your font. We're going to do this in a web standards-based way, but we will do so with enough, frankly, obfuscation so that the font isn't technically just on the server. You know, we're going to base 64 encode it. We're going to split it into segments that get recombined on client side. You know, we're going to do all this stuff. And you can still reverse engineer all of that stuff, but it's actually, again, easier to do the right thing. It's, you know, like it's much easier to just like buy a Spotify subscription now and listen to and find all the music than to still like try to piece together albums from BitTorrent sites and all that crap. You can use user experience to do a better job than piracy, and you can charge a little bit for that. And so that was the nature of
fonts.
That's exactly what we went out and said. Yeah. We're going to use a subscription-based model. People can have all they can eat fonts, and we will charge based on usage rather than licenses. Very, very simple. And it worked very, very well.
Yeah, clearly. And it's, again, yet another thing, thriving, killing it to this day. So that was 2008, huh? It's been around a hot while, kind of early, if not the first one of these commercial font things. Now there's a few competitors, but still probably the one that's most talked about.
Yeah. And so we ran that for a while. We grew it, and it grew really quickly, and it was a tremendous experience. One of the best professional collaborations I've had was the team of people that we built or that we hired and put together. And And it was just like these people, I get a little emotional talking about like how awesome that team was and how much fun we had building all of that stuff. And how well that frankly persisted into Adobe, which acquired us in 2012. Does that sound right? 2011? I don't know. Now I can't keep track anymore. But yeah, we brought that team and the product over to Adobe at a time that was just ripe for change over there. I mean, it was perfect timing.
You're still don't you feel like a pebble in the stream of Adobe? I mean, you came over and were able to affect major change, but you must have been ripe for change, because I feel like like the number of people you brought, it was nothing compared to
who worked there, right? So we had our amazing 28-person team, and we brought them into a 13,000-person company. but we brought them to the just the right place in that company, right? So part of the acquisition, the intent there was, look, the model that you guys have created, this idea of design as a service as opposed to design tools as a thing you buy on a DVD, like that was the shift that Adobe was going through. They were like, that model is exactly what we're trying to build. Can you help us? And so so that led to us integrating Typekit very deeply into Adobe, and me and some of my colleagues like basically stepping up into leadership positions to help make the migration from the Creative Suite into the Creative Cloud successful. And that was, I'll tell you, that was honestly some of the hardest work I've ever done in my career, because it was much less about, honestly, good user experience. It was much more about giant corporate change and falling back on good user experience as the method for that change, which was for any large corporation, you know, a difficult transition.
Well, I'm curious about the experience from web designer to startup entrepreneur to successful exit to now corporate changer from the inside. How was that whole experience for you?
There's a lot of ways I could answer that question. There's two.
Web designer to startup entrepreneur. I feel like a lot of people are maybe in that situation. Like they're like, I want to do my own thing or my own product.
There's two big themes there. One is a little bit facetious, which is that I have this tremendously short attention span, and which means I get bored very quickly, which makes me a terrible employee. And so I keep trying to do new stuff, and I'm always like, people have often asked me about the risk involved in like leaving a good job. Like I left a job at Google, like, you know, leaving a really good job to do something completely ambiguous and very, very risky. And I was like, oh, I never thought of that way. You know, I'm just like, I just want to work on some other stuff. And I don't think I can do that here at Google. So I'm going to go do it on my own. Which is this, I think, one of the traits of entrepreneurship, which is this delusion where, you're just blinded by optimism and again, that short attention span to be able to like, let's just go do some new stuff. Wouldn't that be fun? Without really rationally weighing all the risk, because if you did, you would never take that step forward, right? Like it's on paper, not a wise thing to do. In your gut, it's the only thing to do. So part of it was that, but that sort of career arc you were describing, the real theme there that I've sort of come to realize almost in retrospect was about control. And that was being a designer and trying to shape products. The thing that always frustrated me were what I believe to be artificial constraints towards the best possible user experience. That is, I have a goal to make this product and it's going to do these things, but now we have to consider this weird business dev relationship, this partnership that my company just entered into. And man, that really messes up this user experience. Like I realized, like, obviously we have to be a profitable company, and one of the ways we do that is through partnerships. But man, nobody considered the experience people would have trying to use our product and that product together. I should have been involved in this partnership so that we could have from the beginning designed a great experience that would benefit both companies. And that's just one example on the business side. The terms of service, we're not allowed to do that because of our licensing agreements. Well, geez, we should have considered the licensing agreements we made when we were, you know, at the very beginning had somebody considering the user experience of that. And you take that on every single category of running a business and you realize, I realized, oh my gosh, I got to be there at the beginning. I got to be there at the beginning, or it's going to be impossible to design a good thing. And that's how I kept leaving behind what I considered smaller jobs for bigger opportunities. It was all about being able to create a user experience where every single constraint, the technical constraints, the business constraints, the legal constraints, all of it could be part of the user experience from the very beginning. And that is what I look for today in my job in the VC world for entrepreneurs that think that way. They don't have to be designers, but they have to be thinking about the user experience of their product in every single thing they do, every decision they make. And that to me is a tremendous competitive advantage. And I just learned that through the course of my career, that is the most likely path to success of a product by using the skills that we learned as designers and bringing that to every aspect of a business.
How do you feel that lack of, I guess, control happens? Is it like one concession at a time and suddenly your garden is filled with snakes? Or how, I guess, how does it kind of, or is it kind of you made a money grab and now you have a separate problem?
No.
How do you feel people get into a situation where they're not considering user experience?
It's that scenario of we don't know what we don't know sometimes, right? Where we just like having user experience on the table at the beginning of a decision-making process in a business has not been a thing that most business leaders have ever considered, like ever. Right? Like there's, especially here meaning Silicon Valley and San Francisco, where I am, has traditionally been the technical co-founders, right? Or the technical founder. So it is a very engineering-based culture to where the technology is at the forefront, and then we figure out what we can do with it, as opposed to starting from where, like we did with Adaptive Path and this practice that we called user experience, we start with the needs people have and work towards them with technology. That's a shifting around, and that has not been something that has been popularized and infused in the DNA of companies for very long. Some companies have great examples of that, but it's a relatively recent phenomenon where that is now starting to become expected. Like that's how you do these things. And that's what I mean in this like era of design that we're in, is that now business leaders are realizing, oh my gosh, we need some of that design. And the answer to that is, yes, you need to consider the user experience in every decision you make. And they're like, oh, you know, like that's a fundamental change. I mean, classic example is work we were doing at Adobe, where before they had a big e-commerce store where you bought all the software. We were shifting to a subscription model. So now we had a plans page, right? So you would have to go figure out what plan you want. And I remember talking to the CEO and he said, look, I totally buy your whole argument. I want the simplest, most elegant and most usable experience that we can have for signing up for the Creative Cloud. And I'm like, great. And so we went back and we started designing a plan page, and there were 24 different plans that you could choose from. And I went back and I said, here's how we get a good, beautiful plans page. We reduce it to 4 plans. And they're like, whoa, 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 whoa. We have this whole model built out. Like, we're going to need the CFO in here and get the head of sales over here. And I'm like, that's the only way you're going to get the experience that we know we need for this is to cut down by an order of magnitude almost the number of offerings that the company has. So you think, like, how does a 13,000 person company that does $4 billion in revenue suddenly rethink its whole business model around the user experience of signing up for the products?
Yeah, right. Is it like, well, the interactive plan has After Effects, but the interactive plus plan has After Effects and
Right, because each one of those plans represented revenue that was accounted for in the business model that helped people reach their numbers on a quarter by quarter basis. You got to change all that. Well, it's really, really hard. So it gets to much more than, could we make this, you know, a less cluttered, more beautiful, what fonts, can we tone down the color palette? None of that stuff matters when you have 24 different things you have to try to walk people through to pick from.
It looks like you won or almost won this one. I'm at creative.adobe.com/plans, and there's 4. There's four plans, which is pretty good, but they're kind of broken up into some sub.
You take some time. You take some time, and you can see, like, yeah, once you get it through one. Well, anyway.
Okay.
don't make me relive all of that.
there's some sleight of hand at work there.
Yes, there is.
Yeah, close though. Okay, so that's fun, and then you were a Typekit, and then the Adobe thing happened. Adaptive Path was an interesting end that happened not so recently. I mean, I'm sure you were long gone, but they're now Capital One.
No, actually, I wasn't. I was still on the board of Adaptive Path, so still relatively active. Not day to day, of course. That was run by a tremendous group of people led by Brandon Schauer, who was the CEO of Adaptive Path. But I did serve on the board for about 5 or 6 years. I thought that was a fantastic outcome where we grew that business. It ran successfully and profitably for 12 years and then found a really good home for it, really, when it was acquired late last year by Capital One, which surprised a lot of people, but not me at all. Like, that was a classic example of this era of design where a giant financial services company suddenly realized that they were feeling behind as things like Square and Apple Pay started to be the way that people interacted with their finances and realized they needed an innovation center, so to speak, in Silicon Valley where they could be competitive around people's personal finances, and technology and user experience was the thing they decided to use to do that. And so it's a perfect fit. Having Adaptive Path be acquired by Capital One, I think, was a great proof point of all of that.
They had the capital to buy it.
Yeah. I see what you did there.
So you probably have a different perspective. It's not the death of UX as Wired maybe pitched it. you probably see it in a different light. It's maybe the success of UX. Is that
absolutely? Yeah. No, I don't see it as the final chapter at all. I actually this stuff is really, really cyclical. If anything, what it means is that more and more user experience design agencies and consulting practices are moving in-house, and the work is happening in-house is because it's too strategic for it to be done by an external vendor. At the same time, I think there will always be the value of having fresh eyes, somebody come in from the outside that's not caught up in all the internal politics to have a look and to make recommendations and to help nudge the course of the big corporate entity in a slightly different direction. But I think all of these acquisitions of design agencies by bigger companies just represents them acknowledging how far behind they are and that they need to quickly invest to ramp up their internal design competency.
We have about, we have limited time left. It'd be interesting to hear more about what's going on now with you with True Sure. Ventures and how it came to be and what you do. And
so True Ventures is a VC, a venture capital fund and firm that is based here in San Francisco and Palo Alto. We have a couple offices there, and they are old friends. I've known many of them for a long time. In fact, one of the partners, Tony Conrad, was a client at Adaptive Path while I was still there, way back 2004 or something, as he was building one of his first companies. And so I've known them for a long time, and they were the first call we made when we got out of Google to say, like, hey, we're thinking of starting a thing. We're pretty sure it's going to require capital to get it off the ground and go quickly, and let's talk. And they became very, very close partners and colleagues and friends. As we grew Typekit, they were the lead investor for both of the rounds of funding that we did. And one of the things I liked, there's many things that I like about the way they run their business. One is a very entrepreneurial focus, very entrepreneur focus. They're very focused on the people who are building the companies and very supportive. And all the terms that they use are very entrepreneur friendly. They are weighted towards the entrepreneur and less so against towards the firm itself, which gives people a lot of flexibility in how they build their companies and things like that. But they've developed this incredible community of founders over 200 companies now have been invested in by True Ventures, and this community is just fostered through events and with all of these ways that we stay connected to help each other build our companies. And that was what was so attractive to me. So that when I was contemplating leaving Adobe and, you know, sort of, I felt like I had done some really great work there and it was time to think about something new, I started talking to True, ostensibly about like maybe building another company, and I'm going to think about it. I don't quite know what my plans are yet. And they said, well, while you think about that, why don't you come over here and have a seat around the table? So I liked that. I had never considered that idea. That if you had told me, you know, when I was starting my career that I would be in finance someday, like that just doesn't make any sense. I would have laughed at you. But what I like about it is that I can bring the experience that I've had building products and building teams that build great products for 20 years to bear with people who are just getting started. And so in a weird way, even though there's all this money involved and all of these financial terms involved and all of that stuff, it is still really kind of a mentoring relationship where I have this experience and here I'm sitting with two co-founders and they're thinking about their product for the very first time. And I can have a lot of influence and help and guidance and like, yes, I've been there too. And here's what we can do. And that's why I like venture capital, at all, is because it's an opportunity to vote with money on things you think could potentially change the world or at least have some kind of impact. And you can do so in a very hands-on way. It's not just a bunch of spreadsheets and where the assets go. It is, who do we want to work with and how can we be helpful? And man, I'm having a blast.
I'm sure it's exposed to lots of ideas, like rapid
tons,
fire, right?
Tons, and it's, yeah, and it's all people who are just so excited and so full of motivation. So it's incredibly infectious just to have these great conversations and look at products every day and stuff like that. So yeah, it's really, really fun. And there's a bit of a trend in the industry around this, like designers joining VCs. My old boss at
it's a thing.
Google. Yeah. My old boss at Google, Irene Au, is now a design partner at Kosla Ventures. John Maeda, who was the president of RISD, Rhode Island School of Design, is at Kleiner Perkins. And there's more examples of that happening. The stuff that's going on at Google Ventures.
Yeah, I think of Daniel Burka was over there.
Daniel Burka and some of the team like Braden and Jake and those guys were part of my team at Google. It's all sort of coming together in a way where the valley and the people who generally have focused the influence of that of the capital in the valley are starting to recognize, wait a minute, there's some value here in design, and it's actually,
yeah, we need some designers.
And the people who think about user experience are people who help us really mitigate some of the risk involved in the investments that we make. And so feels great. I think it's awesome. It's a remarkable thing that's happening.
My old friend Kevin Hale is at Y Combinator doing a similar thing, I think.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Do you think that's something maybe smaller markets like the Bostons and Austins need to maybe pay attention to in terms of getting design kind of at the front of that conversation?
I'm not sure geography has that much to do with it, with the exception of no matter where you start your business, especially if it's a tech business, you end up spending time in Silicon Valley. But I think less and less so being here is actually an advantage. I think this is frankly one of the most expensive places to start a company right now, in San Francisco or in the Valley. And we are just getting so good at distributed and remote work. So I still do think like the center of things, the gravitational pull is still here, but I don't think it's mandatory necessarily to be here. It's interesting to see how that is shifting around, and it's something I'm super supportive of.
So is there anything else you want to tell us about what you're doing now or the future or advice for us?
The future.
Well, future. I know. Wow. That's the vague.
when we meet you in our VR headsets, what would you tell us?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. I'm having a lot of fun right now. I think I think it's still remains just a great time to be a designer, a great time to do your own thing as a designer. It could possibly be the best time ever. And I just, I hope people share that optimism because things are really fun right now.
That's a lovely sentiment.
Yeah, that's a good one to end on. I was going to end on a gotcha. So if you have a great history of building webs and websites and web standards, if you were to start today, would you start web or native?
I have no idea. I'm not sure I would even think about it that way. The one difference is, well, I mean, I can't. It totally depends. I started in publishing. And that was how that led me to my career. You could just start in pure startup. You could start with like,
API.
It's impossible
first,
to tell. Yeah. Okay. Like it literally is impossible. Would you start with a big, like building stuff for the enterprise? You might still be doing websites. Would you be like doing stuff on purely for consumers, for end users at home? You'd probably be starting on the phone first. It like, the unbelievable amount of diversity, like you might not even be working in quote unquote technology, right? Just all of the industries that are out there, to think that we would like be using our phones to eliminate taxi cabs and everybody in Uber, is that like starting with web design? Like, I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just the world today is so dramatically different than where everything started 20 years ago that it would be virtually impossible to tell.
I love that perspective. Well, I think, Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate that. We know your time is valuable. If people aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that? And then what's one thing you'd like to plug before you go?
Honestly, just follow me on Twitter. That's all you need. You can go check out the website at trueventures.com to see a little bit about what we're doing over there. But
pretty nice looking for a VC website, I have to say. Normally
we just redid that actually. We just redid that with Mule Design. Mike Montero and Erica Hall helped me make this new website. So yeah, I think they did a wonderful job on that. So check that one out and then just follow me on Twitter if you want to know what I'm up to. And that's just my last name, Veen.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe in your podcatcher of choice. Follow us at Shop Talk Show on Twitter.
I want to thank our sponsors again, the very people who make this show possible at all. One of them is Environments for Humans, our longtime amazing sponsor, doing their Content Strategy Summit, which is pretty fabulous. So it's literally contentstrategysummit.com coming up September 21st through 22nd. Runs all day from like 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Central Time, so that adjusts pretty well for time zones, which is kind of great. You don't have to fly anywhere to do it. You do it all online, and you get recordings of it, so you can revisit the day forever. If you have to run out and you miss one, it's no problem. You can watch it again. You can ask questions of all these people. There's lots of questions flying around because it's an online chat room. It kind of makes interaction a little more intense than it is at live conferences. I found that pretty, pretty great. 2 days, all new talks, September 21st through 22nd, an online roundtable with Christina Halverson. We've had her on the show. She's so great about all this content stuff, but everybody's so great. Stephanie Hay, Jenny Reddish, Caroline Jarrett, Lori Packer, lots of great content people. No travel hassle, no restaurants, no hotel, no planes. You know, life happens. That's why they include full access to the recordings of each session in addition to copies of the presenter's slides and event recordings. You and your team can watch the recordings as many times as you choose. Pretty fabulous content. Just vital. Gotta know about it. Gotta do it. Gotta live it. This episode is also sponsored by lynda.com, LYNDA.com. Oh, we told you about them at the top of the show, and we've told you about them before. It's the biggest online learning resource there is at the on the web. First of all, you get your free 10-day trial if you go to lynda.com/shoptalk. But you know, once you have that membership, you can watch and learn from the top experts who are passionate about teaching. You know, they find these experts and they bring them in and they build these full quality courses. So they, you know, they're handpicked. It's not just anybody. These are top experts. You stream the video, thousands of videos, over 3,000 video courses, which is just crazy. So it's all kinds kinds of all kinds of different things. You know, you want to learn the latest Illustrator? Cool. You want to learn how to wireframe websites in Illustrator? Great, they got that. You want to learn to build apps for Android? Cool, they got it. Up and running with Java? Done. Localization for developers? Cool, they got a class on that. Growth hacking, building stuff for Android Wear, getting started with Swift. Oh, so much stuff. You can build your own iOS apps through, you know, as you're learning with these courses. Pretty great. You know, there's a transcript for every single course. So if accessibility needs are kind of handled a bit there. You can take notes right through their app. So you can be, you know, you're taking the course and writing down and kind of saving stuff as you go. It's a literally, it's an at your own pace kind of thing. You can, you know, once you're logged in and you have an account in there and your membership, you can be making playlists and marking stuff that you want to watch later, and it just, it can be your home base. It could be what you watch instead of TV at night. Pretty nice. That's lynda.com/shoptalk.
If you hate your job, go to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Get a new one. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
That's it, I think. Thanks for listening. shoptalkshow.com.